nation. By now, this generation had come to believe in the credo of the Whole Earth Catalog. We are as gods, and we might as well get good at it. And let's consider the youngest generation of the latest awakening, 13ers entering childhood. Amid the gathering turbulence of 1964, baby-making abruptly fell out of favor. In the spring of that year, American women were still giving birth at a record pace. But in the months that followed, conceptions plummeted. And by mid-1965, the U.S. fertility rate was entering its steep post-boom decline. The reasons for this sudden turn included birth control pills, nascent feminism, and a new society-wide hostility toward children. America's new consciousness celebrated youth as an ideal, but wasted childhood as an actual living experience, moving from what Leslie Fiedler called a 1950s-era cult of the child to what Landon Jones called a 1970s-era cult of the adult. Parents were shunned if they tried to bring small children into restaurants or theaters. More rental apartments started banning children. The ascendant zero population growth movement declared each extra child to be pop pollution, a burden on scarce resources. Sacrificing one's own career or conjugal happiness for the sake of the kids became passé, even, by the logic of the era, bad for kids themselves. Awakening-era parents spent 40% less of their time on child-raising than parents had spent in the high. The Awakening's casual sex, non-traditional families, and mind-altering drugs left a large imprint on this child generation. By the late 70s, once 13ers began practicing what they had learned, adults grew accustomed to seeing kids dress and talk as knowingly as Brooke Shields in ads or Jodie Foster in film. As the media standard for the typical American family changed from my three sons to my two dads, divorce struck 13ers harder than any other child generation in U.S. history. At the end of the high, half of all adult women believed that parents in bad marriages should stay together for the sake of the children. But by the end of the awakening, only one in five thought so. By 1980, just 56% of all 13er children lived with two once-married parents. And today, this generation's novels and screenplays bristle with hostile references to parents who didn't tough it out. Polls have since shown 13ers far more inclined than older Americans to believe current divorce laws are too lax. The events of the Awakening reinforced the impression that grown-ups were neither powerful nor virtuous. To the child's eye, adults were simply not in control, either of their own personal lives or, during the years of Vietnam, Watergate, and gas lines, of the larger world. Instead of preventing danger or teaching by example, adults were more apt to hand out self-care guides that told kids about everything that might happen and how to handle it on their own. It was an era in which everyone and everything had to be liberated, whether it was good for them or not. Nowhere were 13er children more liberated than in awakening-era schools, where high-era education now stood accused of having dehumanized boomer children. Reformers tried to boost child self-esteem through person-centered education that stressed feelings over reason, empirical experience over logical deduction. The average time children spent on homework fell to half of what it had been in the high era, and grade inflation ran rampant. As the awakening progressed, the percentage of high school graduates who described themselves as straight-A students nearly tripled. The awakening's new hostility to power, authority, and secrecy had one meaning for 45-year-olds seeking a nuanced view of a complicating world, but another for 10-year-olds trying to build dreams. For the silent, taught to think big as crisis-era children, thinking small was a midlife tonic. But never having had their own chance to think big, pre-adolescent 13ers heard a new message. America's best days were over. Like the child of divorce writ large, this generation wondered if it was just a coincidence that they came along just at the moment in history when older people started complaining that everything in America began falling to pieces. During the consciousness revolution, as older generations stripped away the barriers that had previously sheltered childhood, 13ers were denied a positive vision of the future, denied indeed any reassurance that their nation had any collective future at all. By the end of Reagan's first term, The awakening had run its course. A new agenda had been set, and the old enthusiasm could not last. Each generation now filled the phase of life it had spent the prior two decades entering, and each was about to break ground into the next. As was the case around 1963, none of the generational archetypes showed signs of matching the role its predecessor had carried into the prior era. How could the silent project anywhere near the hubris of the aging conquerors, building their great society and demanding their entitlement? How could the boomers possibly emerge as midlife mediators, looking beyond themselves for procedural solutions? How could 13ers come of age preaching about moral perfection? How could American parents tolerate yet another underattended child generation? None of that had any chance of happening. Toward the end of any awakening, generational strains begin to show. When the silent begin edging into elderhood, boomers into midlife, and 13ers coming of adult age, their prior social roles could not continue. The awakening was over. As Roland Stromberg had predicted in the middle 1970s, eventually the mood of that era will be revealed as simply one more exhausted option, and so a new one will have to be invented. The second turning necessarily had to give way to the third. The current third turning, called the Culture Wars, began in 1984 and is due to end in approximately 2005. "It's morning in America," exulted President Reagan in his State of the Union message on January 15, 1984. "America is back, standing tall, looking to the 80s with courage, confidence, and hope." As California's governor during the prior era, Reagan had stood firm against the consciousness revolution and symbolized the primacy of the establishment. Now he symbolized the defeat of that establishment and the primacy of the self. Reagan detested the rules and taxes and penalties of the very system he ran, and, buoyed by the feel-good veneer of the economy and moment, people loved it. The awakening was over, and people discovered they were comfortable with what America had become. Early in the unraveling, the postmodern complexities of life struck neoliberals and neoconservatives as exciting new challenges. By the mid-90s, the mood had sobered, with 3 in 4 adults believing the United States to be in moral and spiritual decline. By then, civic attitudes had transformed into the opposite of what they had been in the high. Where America had once experienced what Barbara Whitehead called an economy of abundance and a psychology of scarcity, the nation now had an economy of scarcity and a psychology of abundance. Broad measures of public trust sank to new lows, yet polls also showed Americans awash in self-esteem. Not trusting government, people did trust the individual, as expressed through the marketplace, cultural diversity, interactive technologies, New Age spirituality, and evangelicalism. From TV talk shows to dependency groups to church basements, the search for personal meaning started with the direct experience of the individual. The self-discovered meanings were then ratified by others attracted to the individual's own niche group. Unlike in the high, there was no such thing as normal public opinion. By the early 1990s, America's niche group conflict came to be known as the Culture Wars, defined by Irving Kristol as a profound division over what kind of country we are, what kind of people we are, and what we mean by the American way of life. 3 basic battlegrounds emerged: multiculturalists against traditionalists, the Sheldon Hackneys versus the William Bennetts, media secularists against evangelicals, the Murphy Browns versus the Dan Quayles, and public planners against libertarians, the Robert Reichs versus the Charles Murrays. The Culture Wars had as many combatants as America had niches, from the Nation of Islam to the Internet. And the new lexicon of the Culture Wars allowed America's post-awakening ideals to be elevated into ideologies. Americans in nearly every niche came to one common conclusion: the institutional order was not working and was not worth defending. President Clinton, presiding over big government, proclaimed in 1996 that the era of big government is over. From courts to campuses, medicine to media, institutional America bathed in a self-criticism that corroborated the external critiques of the prior era. Americans turned cynical. Lacking a central direction in civic life, Americans began searching for it in narrow spheres. Despairing over the numbing complexity of what Cornel West calls a decaying civilization, Americans avidly began talking about new ideals of total social cooperation and testing them out on small scales. By the mid-1990s, pundits agreed that America was deep into a new era of lost purpose and shattered consensus, what William Raspberry called an unraveling. A series of jolts propelled this new mood. The 1987 stock crash and ensuing Wall Street scandals cut short the jovial talk about the greed is good yuppie. The Cold War and Desert Storm victories produced a new world order that felt ephemeral and disquieting. The collapse of healthcare reform confirmed that America no longer had faith that big institutional solutions could solve public problems. The whipsaw elections of 1992 through 1996 accelerated the de-alignment of national politics. The Oklahoma City bombing revealed maniacal passions seething just beneath the surface. The Simpson trial and Million Man March evoked a sullen new racialism. With each jolt, yet another piece of the old order lay in disrepute, its workings less respected, its directions less tolerable, its outcomes less predictable. The 1990s are generating plenty of what in other eras would pass for good news. The economy perks along, and the stock market roars. School achievement is going up, the crime rate down. While the U.S. reigns as the sole superpower in a multilateral world, American culture is spreading all over the globe. The big hand on the atomic scientist's doomsday clock, which hit 3 minutes to midnight in 1984, has since retreated. Yet Americans are more pessimistic than ever. They're inclined to believe that any good news, like a roaring stock market, comes with a sinister edge, big layoffs, for which a price will someday be paid. The unraveling mood turn is a natural consequence of the life cycle transitions taking place among today's generations. The confident, entitled GIs are weakening. The other focused, compromise-minded silent are vacating midlife. Boomers are exiting young adulthood after having embroiled it in self-discovery, argument, and new social pathologies. The departure of 13ers from childhood leaves people of all ages, them included, wondering what went wrong. New millennial babies are being born. The society is moving into an archetypal constellation that will reach an apogee of inner, private power and a nadir of outer, public power. Like other eras, an unraveling is a natural phase of human history. Now is the time a society clears away institutional detritus. With the awakening over and no crisis yet on the horizon, an unraveling enables people to live life to the fullest, consume off the past, and pursue individual ends. Human civilization would be far poorer without such an opportunity, once per seculum, to explore the private realms of self-fulfillment, even if it comes with public pessimism. In many ways, a third turning can be the most personally enjoyable of the secular seasons. So too is an unraveling a necessary phase. By empowering the ideals of the awakening, it lays the agenda for the crisis to follow. As in other turnings, the mood of an unraveling results from the gradual aging of the generational archetypes. Artists entering elderhood, prophets entering midlife, nomads coming of age, and heroes being born. Entering old age, artists remain as other-directed as before, institutionally flexible, culturally sensitive, and committed to process and expertise. They seldom produce strong, decisive leaders. Just as they once took cues from hero elders, they now adopt the agenda of younger prophets while wishing to be accepted as full partners in the new values regime. Entering midlife, prophet generations display first a reflective distance and gradually a sober severity in a phase of life previously known for tolerance. Midlife prophets begin reshaping institutions from the inside out, taking the insights they had earlier cultivated in private life and projecting them into public life. They come to political power slowly but resolutely, beginning with relatively weak leaders tolerant of their peers' self-immersed impulses. as they re-sacralize institutions not in line with their values, passionate splits emerge between factions with competing moral positions. Lacking a generational core, young nomads are defined by their very social and cultural divergence. Galvanized as individuals, they take entrepreneurial risks and begin sorting themselves into winners and losers. Their culture develops a frenetic, hardened quality, provoking next elder prophets to accuse them of lacking a principled inner life. Nomads shake off these criticisms and do what they must to get by. Child heroes are nurtured with increasing protection by pessimistic adults in an insecure environment. Children are urged to be obedient achievers and team players. To older prophet parents, hero children are instruments through which their inner visions can someday be achieved. To younger nomad parents, they are beneficiaries of a hard-fought effort to rediscover and reclaim a close family life. America is now more than a decade into the current unraveling, with roughly another decade remaining. Over the next 10 years or so, the usual linear forecasts are correct. Into the new millennium, today's generations will display much the same persona as they do now, except in a more exaggerated and slightly older form. But in so doing, they will be traveling to the threshold of yet another transformation whose nature and consequences the linearists cannot fathom. Starting at the top of the unraveling's generational constellation, let's take a look at the silent generation as they enter elderhood. The silent are well on the way to becoming the first generation in U.S. history never to produce a president. They haven't even had a vice president. Yet they have established themselves as a preeminent helpmate generation, with 3 first ladies, Jackie Kennedy, Rosalind Carter, Barbara Bush, and an unprecedented 4 decades of behind-the-scenes prominence on White House staffs, from Pierre Salinger, Joe Califano, and Bill Moyers in the 60s, to Dave Gergen, Mac McClarty, and Leon Panetta in the 1990s. During the Awakening, the Silent helped an older generation run the nation and a younger generation challenge those elders. During the Unraveling, when the Silent should have taken charge, they have helped GIs linger and boomers pass them by. Having spent a lifetime looking beyond themselves, the Silent reached their turn at leadership only to find others looking beyond them too. Their elder accomplishments, adding new definitions of fairness, new layers of process, new levels of expertise, and new categories of diversity, enhanced the amenities but did little to address the nation's core challenges. Like the law many Silent deem their greatest achievement, the Americans with Disabilities Act, their best efforts always helped somebody out but tied other people in knots. Now, as the unraveling deepens and power drifts away, this generation feels a post-midlife passage that Daniel Levinson has described as a silent despair, a pressing fear of becoming irrelevant. Wincing at younger generations' troubles with the unraveling-era economy, the Silent are embarking on old age feeling a vague dissatisfaction about their supposed luck as an inheritor generation grown old. They comprise America's wealthiest ever elders, completing a stunning 2-generation rags-to-riches transformation of American old age. Where the high era lost watched their growing offspring whiz past them economically, the Silent tower over the living standards of their children. Much as David Broder closes each year with a column acknowledging his gaffes, the Silent are closing their careers by reflecting on their mistakes and how they might make amends. Retired public officials admit easily to past errors, yet are annoyed to hear their legislative artifacts of tolerance, compassion, and due process come under sharp attack from younger politicians. Unfortunately, lamented Pat Schroeder upon announcing her retirement, the Washington I'm leaving is meaner than it was when I arrived. What chills the blood of aging liberals like Daniel Moynihan is the realization that in their youth, the old bastards were the conservatives. Now the young people are becoming the conservatives, and we are the old bastards. As more silent incumbents retire rather than persevere, this generation's core of expertise is becoming ever more irrelevant. Through the rest of the unraveling, the silent will rejuvenate what it means to be old in America. Leisure World and Sun City will lose popularity, as silent tastemakers prefer townhomes within reach of restaurants, theaters, and sports arenas patronized and run by younger people. Boomerang households will mature into extended families that can endure. Older people with hopelessly fractured families will experiment with non-traditional living arrangements. Many will be old goofballs, more childlike than their grandchildren. Others will become expert at what they dabbled in when young. They will travel to national parks with their smocks and berets, easels and paints. They will turn their basements into photo labs, recording studios, or computer workshops. In the decade ahead, the silent will find themselves the unwitting fulcrum of a sweeping turn in America's attitudes about old-age public dependency. Unlike GIs, the silent will not feel entitled. They came of age in the careerist 1950s, not in do-without 1930s or the global war 1940s. Their prior public deeds will not inspire them, or others, to lobby for a vast elder reward. Moreover, younger people will ask why government treats elderhood as perennial dependency if so many unraveling-era golden oldies are able to live such aesthetically fulfilling lives and in such gorgeous pleasure palaces. Given the diverging economic fortunes of the low-benefit McJobs worker and the early retiring and golden-parachuted pensioner, many young people will express resentment at seeing their large FICA taxes going to pay for a year in Provence or a master bedroom jacuzzi. The silent would be easy targets for generational war, except that their open-mindedness and un-GI-like fascination with youth will make them elders whom younger people enjoy being around. To deflect the inevitable youth criticisms, the silent will play to the heart and suggest intergenerational co-caretaking, reasserting the mutual duties between young and old. Their sense of guilt and instinct for compromise will compel them to give in some, relax their claims on young workers, and drain the electricity out of the third rail of Social Security politics. As the silent offer to accept a modest but important measure of sacrifice, they will succeed in completing their lives without ever having had a major quarrel with another generation, cementing their reputation as the most other-directed generation of their time. Next, let's examine the boomer generation's entrance into midlife. When the GI Lloyd Benson told Dan Quayle, "You are no Jack Kennedy," the insult was partly generational. In midlife, boomers are not GIs. They are not as eager to take JFK-style long strides or get America moving again as they are to think deep thoughts or get America to tend its soul. Offering themselves as America's midlife magistrates of morality, boomers are stirring to defend values, monogamy, thrift, continence, that other generations do not associate with them. Today's boomer-style values politics had its roots in the Awakening. The temperament of the boomer-dominated Congress has a recognizable link to the 60s kids in jeans with bullhorns. What the New York Times calls the new churlishness echoes what occurred once on radicalized Awakening-era campuses. Now, as before, the advantage goes to whomever yells the loudest and has the best conversation enders. Everything gets hyperbolized. In boomer battles over symbols, polarization is easy, compromise hard. In 1992, when Americans elected their first boomer president, his campaign slogan, "It's the economy, stupid," and governance showed a distinctly generational flavor. Bill Clinton is smart but distractible, habitually late to an event or issue, after which he focuses like a laser beam. Gifted in gestures of empathy, Clinton can persuasively flaunt his inner self to enhance his popularity. As a candidate and president, he has reminded many people, including his own peers, of his generation's best and worst qualities. The 1994 Republican onslaught was the first election determined by boomer votes, and the 20th century's largest generational landslide. In the states, boomer governorships rose from 18 to 28. Empowering a new peer-driven movement to devolve power to the states. In the House, boomers gained the Speaker's chair and a solid majority. Only the U.S. Senate resisted the tide and remained in silent hands, where it acquired the telling reputation as an island of politeness and moderation. As boomers stoked the talk shows, their first Congress drowned out consensus seekers, talked openly of default, and demanded that the government be reformed or closed. Thus has the American government, from GI to silent to boom, gone from moonwalk to gridlock to train wreck. By 1996, the Clinton-Dole race between the talker and the doer updated the old boomer GI generation gap. Dole was a standard-issue GI on one last mission for my generation. Not an evangelical, not a credentialed culture warrior, not a person who could grok values in the now-dominant boomer tongue. His nomination speech was critical of the boomer elite, who, he said, never grew up, never did anything real, never sacrificed, never suffered, and never learned. The mere nomination of Dole was a slap in the face to a generation that, he implied, lacked the character to exercise power responsibly. Dole's peers had earlier turned over leadership to their grown children. Now, said Al Gore, it's not fair to take back the reins. Before the early 90s, when boomers finally wrested national power from GIs, most of those who wanted to turn the status quo upside down had argued with, but mostly voted for, Democrats. Since then, those who felt like revolutionaries argued with, but mostly voted for, Republicans. Between 1987 and 1994, the Times Mirror survey chronicled a doubling of moralist types as a share of all voters, two-thirds of the increase coming from boomers alone. By the mid-1990s, more than twice as many boomers came to call themselves conservatives than liberals, a difference that said less about their politics than about their self-perception as totally rooted and self-secure, beyond the reach of opinion or edict or even sociability. The midlife boomer obsession with values is propelling a huge growth of evangelical and New Age believers. Two boomers in three say they've been touched by a supernatural power. Among their elders, less than half do. America's middle-aged believers are fleeing mainline churches for fast-growing fundamentalist, charismatic, and breakaway redeemer sects that dress casually or ethnically, sing lively songs, listen to guitar and brimstone homilies, erupt in periodic applause, and engage in other rites drawn from the recovery movement. Boomers are adding new chic to old S-words like sacred, spiritual, soul, sin, shame, and Satan. Books on heaven, hell, out-of-body, and near-death experiences have become bestsellers. Angel Books sold 5 million copies in 1993 alone. The unraveling's boomer-led family is predicated on a rebirth and blending of gender roles. Midlife women recall their GI mothers as not assertive enough. Midlife men recall their fathers as not reflective enough. Both are taking steps to correct this in themselves and others. Crafting a post-awakening masculinity as suitable for churches as for homes, boomer males are rejecting GI man's manliness and silent angst for a new gender definition Newsweek calls the godly man. They are massing in wilderness retreats, the Million Man March, and evangelical Promise Keepers rallies where men hold hands in a football stadium. The list of men's books has turned into a flood, from the Dave Barry's Guy Culture to mythopoetic literature to tales of gender spirituality. On race, boomers are rerooting a traditional ethnic consciousness and asserting an intense new spirituality. Across ideologies, boomer blacks agree that awakening-era laws and programs helped them as individuals, but also engendered a culture of poverty that damaged their communities. They are more likely than their white peers to be born again and favor school prayer, and often voice regret that the core of African-American leadership has passed from churches to government. As they back away from traditional civil rights organizations, boomer blacks are less likely than the silent to stress pluralism or solicit money from white taxpayers or private donors. Instead, says one Muslim, they are intent on replacing the integrated head on the civil rights movement's black body with a black head. Much of the new race talk is away from procedural rights and equal opportunity and towards strengthening families, stopping crime, and saving children. If rectifying civic virtue requires harsh new restrictions on child freedoms, boomers everywhere, from inner cities to walled suburbs, are fully prepared for them. To date, the child's world is the one place where this middle-aged generation has fully focused. Yet the severe, intrusive, perfectionist approach boomers have applied here is a sure sign of what will gradually happen elsewhere as the unraveling continues. As boomers move more deeply into midlife, their collective mindset will grow more judgmental, snobbish, and severe. By nurture and habit, they will remain disinclined to do the regular or polite things that facilitate community life. Yet by midlife conviction, they will become what E.J. Dionne describes as civic liberals and civic conservatives, obsessed with restoring American citizenship. This will pose a conundrum for boomer parents and leaders as they traverse the millennium. How can a generation that can't march in a row tell others to do so? Graying boomers will respond by tying their awakening-era credos about personal growth and authenticity ever more tightly to new imperatives of social altruism. Many will redefine their jobs to stress the inspirational or preaching role. America will see more of what Newt Gingrich calls didactic politicians, public crafters of what Bennett calls the architecture of the soul. Come the OOs, boomers will begin to find new uses for government. Where the first half of the unraveling saw the rerooting of boomer Republicans, the second half will see the rerooting of boomer anti-Republicans. Like Mickey Kaus in End of Equality, boomer liberals will propose replacing the remnants of the Great Society with something less materially promising but more morally exacting. Yet no matter who gains high office, liberals or conservatives, many backers of the winning faction will wonder if high office in an era of ideological rage and train-wrecked government is where they really want to be, and if a tactical loss might not prove to be a strategic victory. For boomer partisans who are out of power, the late unraveling will mainly be an occasion to retool and jockey for long-range advantage. On the culture wars front, boomer communitarians, liberal and conservative, will gradually prevail over the libertarians. They will zero in on what Martha Bayles calls the hole in our soul, the loss of beauty and meaning in America's unraveling culturama. What John Leo calls hair-trigger Puritans will attack licentiousness in the belief that the whole community is threatened by misdirected private pleasures. Boomer virtucrats of all ideologies will increasingly distrust any path that doesn't hurt. The prescription will not be a sugar-coated cure, but a purgative tonic. From chain gangs to diet loaf prison food to courtrooms where victims confront criminals, boomers will re-stigmatize crime and emphasize expressive justice that judges the sinner along with the sin. Boomer rhetoric will offer many polarizing arguments, but few big institutional changes. National politics will become an arena for fierce arguments about new proposals that even the strongest partisans will know can't yet be enacted or enforced. Boomer congresses will find ways to separate arguments about the federal budget from the budget itself, which will grind away without fundamental change. Not able to decide who is worse, the rich or the poor, boomers will censure them both and impose symbolic but minor punishments. Some supposedly excessive income will be taxed from the one side, some undeserved welfare slashed from the other. The result will be a vast and rusted-out public sector stripped of an engine, but with nothing ready to replace it. Influencing these policy debates will be new stock figures, the roving philosopher professionals, their careers held together only by the twisting thread of their own personality. The cutting-edge idea prescriptors will be author politicians like Al Gore, Bill Bennett, or Bill Bradley, people who fuse spirituality with grassroots activism. Many boomers who preach honesty and sacrifice will remain personally self-indulgent, like Bill Gates, whose eco-friendly mansion has a garage for 20 cars. The cultural elite will consume heavily while pretending otherwise. Where GIs once liked to surround themselves with regular and rational and progressive things, boomers will prefer the unique and sacred and traditional, and they will redefine what progress means. Already they are attacking such old GI yardsticks as the gross domestic product on the grounds that they overmeasure the mere payment of money, since divorce lawyers and industrial pollution technically add to the GDP. And undermeasure what truly matters, since saving a species or teaching values to children count as zero. Materially, most boomers freely concede that they're not living much better in middle age than their parents did. At age 40, where a typical GI worker during the high enjoyed a 2/3 rise in real pay over the previous generation at the same age, a typical boomer worker has shown no real improvement. yet their self-esteem remains indomitable. By a 5-to-1 ratio, 1990s-era boomers consider their careers better than their parents, and by 9-to-1, their lives more meaningful. By the 00s, those views will harden. Downwardly mobile boomers will face the truth about the way they live now with some dignity and grace, writes Katie Butler. If it's by choice and it's not overwhelming, having no money can be a way of entering more deeply into your life. Boomer recusants who choose not to achieve by any worldly standard will have second thoughts about information age technology. For many, the 00s will be time to shed the tech toys, abandon workaholism, and downshift. In family and financial affairs, the late unraveling will be a sobering time. Boomers will have to say farewell to most of their remaining GI parents, often after a geographic separation dating back to the awakening era and fumbled efforts at reconciliation that betray mixed motives on both sides, as in Bud Light's "I Love You, Man" commercial. Parental death will confront boomers with an embarrassing reality for people their age, that the providers they had somehow counted on are gone, and that what's left, in inheritance, is somehow not as much as they had imagined. Thrift will become a big, late, unraveling buzzword among boomers, as they make a big deal out of all the income they are diverting into mutual funds. But as always, this generation will have trouble following through. Some will resist the notion of disciplining themselves for the sake of lucre. Others, looking at the run-up in stock and bond prices caused by their sheer midlife numbers, will assume the market boom will last forever and cut back on savings accordingly. Politically, boomers will continue to support Social Security and Medicare for their own parents, while also believing that both will be bankrupt by the time they retire. Into the 00s, their leaders will talk constantly, but do very little about this looming threat to the material security of their own age, a threat that will now loom closer. Gradually, the old wry detachment will give way to a jarring new focus. Boomers will at long last be ready to accept full responsibility for their own old age and for hard choices facing their nation. Next, let's look at 13ers as they enter young adulthood. America's college class of 1983 came with a new label, the first public welcome of their coming-of-age generation. Around the time of their graduation, the U.S. Office of Education published a major report, A Nation at Risk, describing the nation's student population as a rising tide of mediocrity, whose learning will not surpass, will not equal, will not even approach that of their parents. This diatribe became the first in a flurry of reports, studies, and books, keynoted by Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind, that castigated America's new youth as mindless, soulless, and dumb. Through the early unraveling years, recent graduates heard older writers and columnists call them a nowhere generation, a tired generation, a generation of animals, a high-expectation, low-sweat generation, and an army of Bart Simpsons, armed and possibly dangerous. In the early 1990s, as Wayne and Garth chanted, "We're not worthy," from a dingy basement, America's 20-somethings begrudgingly settled on the label Generation X. Today's youths often regard their own circles of friends as too diverse to be thought of in collective terms. Compared to every other generation born this century, theirs is less cohesive, its experiences wider, its ethnicity more polyglot, and its culture more splintery. Yet all this is central to their collective persona. From music to politics, to academics to income, today's young adults define themselves by sheer divergence, a generation less knowable for its core than by its bits and pieces. As the 1990s have progressed, young adults have asserted more control over their own image. The generational TV shows have taken X from the glitzy Beverly Hills 90210 to the atomized Melrose Place to the ersatz community of Friends, whose cast resembles the people who watched those other X shows. Many of the storylines depict youths as noncommittal, unattached, brazen about sex and work, obsessed with little things, and isolated from the worlds of older people or children. X got hyper-marketed, declared Copeland in 1995, and now I'm here to say that X is over. From Copeland to Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder, Putative leaders of the youth culture declared no interest in speaking for anybody. The whole ex-persona has come to be perceived as such a mess that nobody wants to identify with it, as if to cut all connection with a loser. Often, talk of ex has degenerated into pretentious put-downs by a boomer-dominated media bent on confirming the superior authenticity of their own awakening-era youth. To hear many 13ers tell it, following boomers into youth is like entering a theme park after a mob has trashed the place and a distant CEO has turned every idea into a commercial logo. "Make love, not war," sounds so absurd to me, sings Extreme, confirming America's latest generation gap. To get a fix on today's young adult generation, forget the X. Look beyond the pop media deluge and skip the boomers. Focus instead on their place in history, number 13, and how different 13ers are at this age from the generation that nurtured them, the silent. Where the silent were children of crisis who came of age in a high, 13ers were children of awakening who came of age in an unraveling. Where the silent grew up just when a hungry society wanted to invest, 13ers grew up just when a satiated society wanted to cash out. Where the silent came of age in an era when individualism was discouraged, but economic success guaranteed, 13ers are coming of age when individualism is celebrated, but economic success is up for grabs. With the silent, prosperity and institutional stability gradually exceeded expectations, allowing them to turn their focus to effect and detail. With 13ers, the opposite happened, and expectations were betrayed. Where the silent came of age with how to succeed in business without really trying, 13ers have the stark declinism of rent, riveting them on the bottom lines of life. Generational economics bear this out. Unraveling era 13ers, males especially, have been hit with a one-generation depression. From 1973 to 1992, the real median income for young adult males fell by 28%, more than it did for the entire nation from peak to trough of the Great Depression. Notwithstanding this harsh youth economy, the image of 90210-style wealth, cars, TVs, CD players, leather logo jackets, has wrapped itself tightly around 13ers. Yet what sociologist Gerald Bachman calls premature affluence has done more harm than good. It is a custom used to parentally subsidize luxuries they cannot possibly afford on their own, and it has persuaded older generations that if some young people aren't doing well, they only have themselves to blame. Lacking any guarantee that slow but steady follow the rules and trust in the future behavior will ever pay off, 13ers tend to view the world as run by lottery markets, in which a person either lands the one big win or goes nowhere. From this fatalism, they have constructed a flinty ethos of self-determination, in which being rich or poor has less to do with virtue than with timing, salesmanship, and luck. What people get is simply what they get, and is not necessarily related to what they may or may not deserve. Their dating and mating reflects much the same quest for risk amid decline, for modularity amid chaos, for doing what works amid constant elder judgments about right and wrong. Where the young silent looked at sex as euphoric, marriage as romantic, and feminism as a thrilling breakthrough, 13ers look at sex as dangerous, marriage as what a St. Elmo's Fire character calls all financial, and gender equality as a necessary survival tool in a world of wrecked courtship rituals, splintered families, and unreliable husbands. As older feminists debate what Deanna Rex calls problems of affluence and success rather than serious ones, 13er women are more concerned about immediate self-defense against AIDS, date rape, and street crime, and longer-term self-defense against potential spouses who might be unreliable providers or abandon their families. As the youngest copulating and oldest marrying generation ever recorded, 13ers maneuver through an unusually long span of sexually active singlehood, with the threat of AIDS ever lingering in the background. They have always been the physical center of the abortion debate, first as the surviving fetuses of the most aborted generation in U.S. history, later as the pregnant unmarried women faced with the choice of what to do. Small wonder 13ers have such split feelings about the consciousness revolution. They fantasize about how the 60s and 70s supposedly offered boomers easy sex without consequence, while feeling bitter about the lasting damage done by an era in which they know they were the babies adults were trying so hard not to have. A similar alertness to hard truths, and anxiety about danger, informs the 13er view of race. They are coming of age in an unraveling era that declares it acceptable for institutions, but not individuals, to discriminate on the basis of race. Exactly the opposite of what the Silent encountered in the High. The 13ers' real diversity problem is less racial or ethnic than economic and familial. Young black professionals are faring nearly as well as white peers, while uneducated 13er blacks are doing worse than one or two generations before. Political surveys show 13ers to be somewhat more conservative, considerably less liberal, and far more independent than older generations are today or were at like age. Never knowing anything except institutional decline, 13ers are deeply skeptical about grand policy visions they assume will somehow only add to America's fiscal debt and social chaos. For many, non-voting is an acceptable social choice. More than 3 13ers in 4 do not trust government to look after their basic interests. As they see it, other people get benefits while they pay the bills. Nearly every major unraveling-era policy proposal on taxes, health care, or Social Security has proposed transferring more money from youth to elders. And 13ers are even less inclined than boomers to believe that paying now will benefit them later when they grow old in their own turn. A third millennium survey found that more 13ers believe in UFOs than in Social Security lasting until they retire. Thus has arisen the downward spiral of 13er civic behavior. They tune out, so they don't vote, so their interests are trampled, so they tune out, and on it goes. Many 13ers prefer to express their community spirit not by voting, but by hands-on volunteering. They believe that society is changed not by presidential orders or million-man marches, but by the day-to-day acts of ordinary people. More than older generations, 13ers believe in doing small acts of kindness as individuals, without caring if anybody applauds or even notices. The president of MIT has likened their civic attitude to that of the Lone Ranger. Do a good deed, leave a silver bullet, and move on. By the early 00s, economics will continue to tell the 13er story. Young adult incomes will be lower, their poverty rate higher, and their safety nets skimpier than was true for boomers in the early 80s, confirming the 13th as the only U.S. generation, aside perhaps from the Gilded, ever to suffer a lifetime economic slide. Many will buffer their downward mobility by working multiple jobs, living in multiple income households or with parents, and streamlining their consumption habits. An unraveling that began unfriendly to entry-level job seekers will close unfriendly to promotion seekers. From professional partnerships to store manager positions, 13ers will find their paths blocked by institutions that aren't expanding and by older generations who aren't leaving. This is already the first generation born in this century to be less certifiably professional than its predecessors. Many 13ers will resign themselves to being permanent temps, no-benefit contractors, second-tier careerists, and lesser-paid replacements. Into the 00s, whatever 30 to 40-ish people do will be criticized by elders, not just for failing to meet the prior standard, but also for being a bad influence on kids. This generation will personify what America will dislike about the widening gap between haves and have-nots. Its failures will be perceived as deserved, its successes as less so. High-flying youths will be condemned as economic predators and appropriate targets of luxury taxation, while low-lifers will be assailed as incorrigible and unworthy of public aid. By the end of the unraveling, the American social category with the greatest reputation for virtue will be the one to which relatively few young adults will belong, the middle class. The 13er high-risk mindset will come under attack as a national affliction. High-stakes entrepreneurs will be busy arbitraging deals and acquiring U.S. assets for foreign interests. They will be making markets more fluid, leveraging more risk, establishing more distance and anonymity in the links between debtors and their creditors, and flooding the world with American pop culture. In cyberspace, they will be hacking, spamming, code-breaking, and tax-evading. For all this, they will come under heavy criticism, prompting urgent new calls for government regulation. At the same time, 13ers will be the fungible workers of the unraveling's globalized economy. where young silent generation workers let others negotiate for them, 13ers will strike their own deals, stressing near-term incentives like piecework or commissions. Where the typical silent expected to stay with a first employer for decades, the typical 13er will expect a rapid turnover of employers and work situations. Economists have long said that this sort of worker is what an ever-changing global economy needs. But once America acquires a whole generation of them, older managers won't be so pleased. The perceived problem won't be whether 13ers work enough, which they will, but rather their distance from corporate culture. Young workers will follow the contract. When it's time to work, they will be totally focused. But when it's quitting time, they will disengage. Many 13ers will skip the institutional world entirely and go it alone or with friends, outpacing and underpricing older rivals, playing crafty high-tech games with and against elder-built systems. A distinctly 13er brand of what Seren Sakurai calls counter-commerce will steal markets from big corporations, undermine rule-encrusted state enterprises, and mount gray-market challenges to credentialed professions. By the 00s, 40-ish novelists, filmmakers, and pop stars will be pushing every niche, every extravagance, every extreme sport, every technology, every shock, sex, violence, profanity, apathy, self-mutilation, to the maximum, prompting boomer calls for boycotts and censorship. As young adult attendance sags at national parks, historic sites, museums, and classical concerts, a clear demarcation will exist between the 13er fun culture and the boomer classic alternative. Sports and celebrity entertainments will acquire a brassy quality, more akin to gladiatorial than civic ritual. Athletes and entertainers will raise sports and media to new heights of commercial superstardom. Star salaries will skyrocket even higher,